From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the writer Sebastian Junger continues his exploration of the human impulses behind war. He's been particularly interested in veterans and their experience of being alienated once they return home from the battlefield. And any discussion of this, he says in the book, has to address the fact that so many soldiers find themselves missing the war after it's over. As awkward as it is to say, Junger says it, part of the trauma of war seems to be giving it up. And why? The answer, he believes, is in the tribe. Soldiers are in a tribe of sorts, where they share a cause and a bond. They fight together. They're afraid together. Junger examines what we can learn from tribal societies about recovering from this kind of trauma. It's about being part of something bigger. The book is called Tribe. He'll join us after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So listen to what Sebastian Junger writes in his new book. If war were purely and absolutely bad in every single aspect, and if it were toxic in all of its effects, it probably would not happen as often as it does. And he's not saying war isn't horrific, and Junger has seen enough of it to know. He's not saying it's not traumatic, but what he's noticed over the years of covering wars is that part of that trauma of returning from a war is giving it up. Not the violence, not the fear, but the friendships. And that's not even a good name for these relationships. It's deeper than that. Junger says it's like a tribe, and it's something deeply embedded in human nature, this feeling of longing and belonging and loyalty. His new book is about why those feelings are rare and precious in modern societies. So he looks to tribal societies for answers. The book is called Tribe, On Homecoming and Belonging. And Sebastian Junger is joining us today to talk about it. Junger directed the documentary film Restrepo alongside the photographer Tim Hetherington, who lost his life documenting a conflict in Libya. He was the subject of Junger's other documentary film, Which Way is the Frontline from Here? Both of those films premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. Junger is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, author of a number of books, among them, of course, The Perfect Storm. And he's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Sebastian Junger, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So this began, if I get this right, as a piece you wrote for Vanity Fair. It's been a year ago now that kind of dealt with this subject. How did it become a book? You figured you had a little bit more to say on the subject?
Well, the piece for Vanity Fair was a kind of running start that I gave myself in order to land on a book. These are things I've been thinking about my entire life. The third chapter talks about soldiers and PTSD, but the book really has as its focus us, yeah, our society. And I feel that soldiers who come from here, go away for a while, experience a very communal existence in combat in a platoon, and then come back to the society, that they allow us to see ourselves quite clearly. In looking through their eyes, we see ourselves anew. And some of the difficulties that returning soldiers have really do eliminate deficits in our society that are affecting everybody.
You begin the book with this story from some 30 years ago now. I want to have you read this section. You were just out of college. You were hitchhiking across the Northwest, and you have this experience. Would you set this up for us and read this section, if you don't mind?
Of course. I was hitchhiking across the country. I was, I don't know, 22 years old. I'd grown up in a very placid little suburb and had felt that I'd never been tested, and this was my chance. And I wound up outside Gillette, Wyoming, a very tough mining town, and I was standing outside on the highway on a cold fall day getting beer bottles thrown at me from pickup trucks, and I see this guy moving towards me up the on-ramp from town. He doesn't look good. He's, clearly homeless and a little derelict, and he's a tough-looking guy, and he's carrying a lunchbox. And I have my little backpack filled with camping gear that I'd saved up for and bought for my trip, and a whole bunch of food and everything I needed. You know, I'd planned this. And he comes up to me and he says, "Hey, where are you going?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to California." And, you know, his hair is matted and he's dirty and, you know, he's pretty threatening looking. And he says, "How much food do you got?" And I thought that he wanted me to open up my bag and that he was going to rob me, you know. And so I said, "Oh, I just got a little cheese." And he said, "Listen, you can't get to California on just a little cheese." And I'll read the next section. The man said that he lived in a broken down car and that every morning he walked 3 miles to a coal mine outside of town to see if they needed fill-in work. Some days they did, some days they didn't. And this was one of the days that they didn't. "So I won't be needing this," he said, opening his black lunchbox. "I saw you from town and just wanted to make sure you were okay." The lunchbox contained a bologna sandwich, an apple, and a bag of potato chips. The food had probably come from a local church. I had no choice but to take it. I thanked him and put the food in my pack for later and wished him luck. Then he turned and made his way back down the on-ramp towards Gillette. I thought about that man for the rest of my trip. I thought about him for the rest of my life. He'd been generous, yes, but lots of people are generous. What made him different was the fact that he'd taken responsibility for me. He'd spotted me from town and walked half a mile out of highway to make sure I was okay. Robert Frost famously wrote that home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to let you in. The word tribe is far harder to define, but a start might be the people you feel compelled to share the last of your food with. For reasons I'll never know, the man in Gillette decided to treat me like a member of his tribe.
Why begin with that story, Sebastian Younger? What does it illustrate about what you're trying to get at in your book?
Well, you know, we live in this miraculous, amazing modern society that has so many benefits, so many blessings. I think I don't even need to enumerate them for everybody. It's obvious. But one of the losses is this sense of shared responsibility for each other. You get it in small neighborhoods. You often get it in poor neighborhoods, frankly. You get it in platoons in combat. You get it after disasters. But the wealthier the society, the less sort of shared concern we all have for each other. I guess it makes sense. But there is a real psychological loss there. And I started with this story because it was my first experience as a kid who grew up in an American suburb. It was my first experience with a stranger spotting me and thinking we're in the same tribe and I'm going to make sure that my brother's okay. You can meet a brother. You can have a brother that you haven't met yet. And he spotted me out on the highway and I think he felt that bond. He thought I was homeless like he was. And he came out to check on me.
So here's the contrast you set up early on in the book. You have sort of two societies here in the early part of American history you're writing about. On one hand, you have this booming industrialist society, emerging technology, all of those kinds of things, mediated by the rule of law. You have that on one hand. And then on the other hand, you have Indian societies, these ancient societies. They were communal, run by consensus, as you talk about. Broadly egalitarian is how you describe them. And you write about early white Americans. You say they had a choice. They could see these two societies. And this was really surprising, a kind of surprising number of these Europeans who came to this new world chose to go to these native societies. They would just sort of walk into the tree line, you say, and disappear. Would you talk about this?
Yeah, I mean, the United States is the only world power that developed, that evolved alongside a, as I say in my book, a howling wilderness filled with Stone Age peoples.
Yeah.
When I was young, I had a sort of uncle figure, a kind of mentor figure named Ellis, who was half Lakota Sioux, half Apache. And he was born in 1929, beginning of the Depression, on a wagon. And he was very well-read, amazing man. And he said to me, you know, all throughout the history of this country, along the frontier, white people were always running off to join the Indians. But the Indians never ran off to join the white people. People go native. They don't go civilized. And I thought about that my whole life. And then when I was writing this book, I decided to look into it because part of that phenomenon was that even people who were captured by the Indians abducted from their homes, from their settlements, and adopted, forcibly adopted into Indian tribes. Often when given the chance to be repatriated by a peace treaty or whatever, they would refuse to take it. They would even go into hiding to avoid being returned to white society. And it reminded me actually of some of the soldiers I knew after the year that I spent out at in eastern Afghanistan off and on with a platoon in combat. Many of the guys in that platoon, after they got back to Italy and had their fun for a while post-deployment, many of them were really depressed and said they wanted to go back to Afghanistan. They did not want to return to the United States. And it reminded me of what my Uncle Ellis had said, and I decided to look into it. And even in the day, in the 1700s and 1800s, writers and thinkers of the era were sort of puzzled and disturbed by this phenomenon. Even Benjamin Franklin said, you know, it's really strange that none of the native peoples want to live with us, but many white people want to live with the American Indians. And the reason, interestingly, that they came up with was that these tribes were egalitarian. It was not they were not burdened by this terrible class system that Western society is. It's a collective society where everyone's basically equal. And thinkers of the day thought that that held an enormous appeal to the settlers.
One of the things that you do not do is romanticize Indian life. I think it's important to point that out. And you point out early on in the book that pretty much all of the Indian tribes of this particular time that you're writing about, this moment in the book anyway, regularly waged war against their neighbors. They practiced horrible torture. You want to say something about that? Because I think, as you say, we need to guard against romanticizing any of this. And you don't in the book. You don't romanticize it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Western society has developed the rule of law, international law, war crime law, that has kept nations more or less well-behaved even during times of conflict. With the Native American tribes, they were what we would call grossly unfair to the enemies, to their enemies. But they were immensely fair to each other. In other words, within the context of their own communities, they were egalitarian. Mm-hmm. There was really no way to accumulate and pass on wealth through the generations. No one was born into positions of great power. You had to sort of earn that through leadership, through prowess in hunting and in warfare. It was really a merit-based society, and in other words, an egalitarian society. And even in the day, I saw several accounts of women who had been abducted and adopted into Indian families, and some of them wound up later through extraordinary circumstances writing about their experiences. And they said, you know, we just had way more freedom and equality in Native society than back in the settlements. So yes, the American Indians were absolutely horrific to their enemies, horrific the way every human society has been towards its enemies, including Western societies. Right. But internally, it was a very, very fair society.
And one of the results of living in societies like this, you said, was not only this extraordinary freedom, but this prompts this kind of loyalty. And you write that loyalty and courage – they were among the most prized virtues. And not only that, this preservation of the tribe, this was a sacred task. Say something about that if you would.
Yeah. I mean, we're primates. We're a social species. And our survival is rooted in the protective capacities of the group. I mean, they're really in the wild, in the natural world, there is no individual survival outside of group survival. It's one and the same thing. And so acting selflessly towards the group, I mean, it looks altruistic and you could argue that it is altruistic, but in the sort of long term, it actually is an excellent strategy for one's own individual survival. And so the in any tribal society, in any hunter-gatherer community, the foremost, the central ethos of belonging to that group is that the group is more important than you yourself are. And you can see that played out exactly the same way in a platoon in combat. And I was in a platoon in combat as a civilian journalist, and you could see it at work. I mean, the guys were incredibly brave and would risk their lives, even sacrifice their lives instantly to help each other. And it is part of that ancient ethos, like, look, I'm not going to survive without you guys anyway, so I might as well risk my life to save your life.
You know, you write about the sort of evolutionary nature of all of this, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about this. Anthropologists talk, the Kung in the Kalahari, and you say that anthropologists say that this is kind of a good, accurate image of how early humans lived for millions of years. And this was before agriculture. And I wanted you to talk about that because it seems like the advent of agriculture made this remarkable, significant change to these societies.
Yes, and there's a wonderful book that I love recommending to people called Sapiens by a writer named Harari that talks in an amazing way about the effect of agriculture on human society. So, you know, I am not an expert on that, and I would point people towards Sapiens. But just, yes, broadly, we humans lived for hundreds of thousands of years as mobile groups of hunter-gatherers in a harsh environment, living in groups of 30, 40, 50 people where everyone contributed to the survival and sustenance of the group. People knew each other extremely well. There was extreme group loyalty. And there was a severe social sanction against acting selfishly, against jeopardizing the group in any way. You know, if this all makes great evolutionary sense, of course.
Right.
And the Kung of the Kalahari, and you know, who through the 70s and 1970s and 80s were living, you know, really a Stone Age existence, partly because no one else, the Kalahari is such a harsh environment that no one else wanted to live there, and they were left alone. But that gave anthropologists the chance to study their economy, to study their society, and the idea was, and I think it's quite accurate, that the Kung represented our evolutionary past quite closely. And what they found was this, you know, extreme collectivism in all things, group child rearing, the sharing of food that was either gathered or hunted. And one of the things that was punished severely was basically scamming the system. If you weren't contributing to the group enterprise, but you were sort of quietly taking your share of food or more than your share of food, that was punished really severely.
Right.
And also alpha males that were sort of tried to bully people into getting more than their fair share, that was punished severely as well. And it was one of the things that one anthropologist found where it was most likely to lead to capital punishment, that the group basically turning on a bullying alpha male and just killing him.
Yeah. Yeah. Christopher Boehm, you refer to, this anthropologist who talks about how in some ways we developed moral behavior based on – that's how we kind of evolved this idea of moral behavior from this group pressure, I guess.
Yes. I think Boehm would argue that moral behavior is a survival adaptation.
Right.
And it increases the group's chances of surviving in a harsh environment. And when you do that, you increase individual survival. And Darwin says that means you pass on your genes, you know, more successfully. And here we are. So
yeah. But then you compare that with modern society, this idea of group pressure and this intolerance for scamming the system. And this comes up toward the end of the book too, this idea where today people can kind of get away with incredible levels of dishonesty without getting caught. I wanted you to say something about that because you, towards the end of the book, you mentioned virtually no one was punished, for example, from the banking industry for the unethical behavior that led to that recession in 2008. And I just wanted you to talk about the idea of accountability, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, I know you know, as a journalist, I feel that we all must refrain from making value judgment, personal value judgments. But what I do in my book is basically say, look, we are the descendants of hundreds of thousands of years of hunter-gatherers, and we are still wired that way. We clearly respond psychologically, emotionally, in positive ways to that kind of group dynamic. And so it's interesting to note that the whole range of fraud in American society, from, quote, welfare fraud at the sort of lower end all the way on up to insurance scams, military contractor fraud, and finally the massive fraud perpetrated on the U.S. economy by a small group of people on Wall Street, mostly men, on Wall Street who triggered the recession of 08, were bailed out to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars in each company, while simultaneously paying themselves year-end bonuses in the tens of millions of dollars. All of that is a massive fraud perpetrated on our society, and that were we hunter-gatherers and the equivalent damage was done to us by select members of our group, the punishment would be swift and severe. And we actually didn't punish those people. I'm not saying we should or shouldn't. I'm just noting that that's a real departure in terms of our human heritage. That's a real departure from hundreds of thousands of years of human behavior.
Yeah, it shows how, as you put it, detribalized the country has become.
That's right. And I think the loss of sense of community, of common purpose in this country, I mean, you can look at it in two ways. You can look at, you know, neighborhood people who live in, you know, in communities, but they don't act communally. I mean, you don't know your neighbors. You certainly aren't depending on your neighbors for your defense, for your food, that kind of thing. I mean, we're a modern society and we've moved beyond that in some, and that's quite liberating actually.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, end of the spectrum, at the sort of macro end, you have very powerful people acting in incredibly selfish ways without any consequences. I mean, the recession of 2008 cost as much as $14 trillion, something like $45,000 per person in this country. And there were no consequences for those people. And when you have politicians who are actually openly mocking and speaking with contempt about our president, about our government, about segments of our population. And when you have very powerful people acting in those ways, the message it sends to all of us unconsciously is, look, there's nothing to belong to. There's no there. We're all in it for ourselves. And I don't think the American public wants that. And I think we actually have – we the people have an enormous power – to an enormous ability that we don't use to force the powerful people in this country to actually at least act well, at least act as if there is a country that we all believe in, that we all contribute to, and to stop basically taking it for all it's worth.
Sebastian Junger is with us, writer, journalist, documentary filmmaker. We're talking about his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Bug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Sebastian Junger is joining us, writer, journalist, documentary filmmaker. His new book examines why the principles of tribes, the bonding, the loyalty, the sharing, why that can be such a rare and precious thing in modern societies and how the lack of all of that is affecting us all. The book is called Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging, and Junger is joining us from a studio in New York City. When you turned 18, you tell a story in the book, you got your Selective Service card in the mail. And so you make this kind of, I don't know, maybe it was a kind of dramatic pronouncement to your family that you're not going to sign this. And your father's response, and he, mind you, we should point out, he was very anti-war, you said, at the time.
Yeah.
But he was really angry about that. Would you tell that story?
He was adamant.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up during Vietnam. I was born in 1962. Every adult I knew was against the war. I lived in a very liberal part of the country, and I absorbed that way of thinking, of course. And so when I turned 18, I got this card in the mail from my government saying, we want to know where you live in case we need to draft you during wartime. I had no idea what I was looking at. And this still happens. Girls don't know about this, but boys still get their draft card in the mail and they have to fill it out. And so I showed it to my father and I said, I'm not signing this, right? Like, this is ridiculous. And to my surprise, he said, no, you're signing it.
Yeah.
He said, you don't owe your country nothing.
Right.
You owe it something, and you might owe it your life. Hopefully not, but you don't know yet. And you know, he grew up in Europe. He was grew up in France. His father was Jewish. He came here during World War II as a young man, and he tried to join the U.S. military. He couldn't because he had asthma. And he said, you know, there's graves of thousands of young American men in his home country of France, and America saved the world from fascism. And you don't know right now if the next war is going to be a moral one, a just one or not. And if it's not, it's your duty to oppose it. But you don't know that yet. So you're signing that card. And when he said that, all of a sudden, what looked like a kind of bureaucratic manipulation, a kind of entrapment, actually became like a privilege, an honor to sign that card. I was part of something bigger, like my country needed me. Mm. And, you know, for an 18-year-old man, that was like an incredibly exciting idea.
So war wasn't about ideology or anything like that. It was about that about something bigger than yourself. That's the thing that was important to you and your dad, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I had very firm political beliefs, and I believe that there were wars that are immoral and should not be fought, should be protested. But I also understood that sometimes war might be necessary.
Yeah.
And certainly when the Germans were sweeping through Europe, that was one of those times. And who knows, that might happen in my lifetime as well. And I better get ready to defend what's right.
Why do little boys, in particular little boys, play war? Because this is something you kind of explore in the book, that it seems like it's not about the violence part. It's about the respect part, the kind of longing for maturity, I guess.
Well, there's two questions. I mean, why do young boys play war? That kind of hunting and fighting behavior is deeply wired into male behavior and clearly is adaptive. I mean, if you look at our evolutionary past, the ability to stalk game and kill game and to defend the group from other aggressive bands of humans was essential to survival. And so anything that is really, really widespread and common in human behavior, you can just assume it had a real adaptive survival value in our past. In modern society, we're not living in this sort of ongoing effort of keeping our immediate community alive. We're not day by day proving our worth to our community. We're marching off to our offices and our cubicles or what have you. And in a context like that, I think young men – I mean young women have a whole different challenge in modern society, but I'm a man and so I'll speak to that. I think young men are at pains to demonstrate that they're brave and that they're loyal to the group and that they're ready to make sacrifices for everybody if need be. I mean, there's just, you know, at modern affluent society, there's almost never a reason to have to demonstrate those things. And unfortunately, in some ways, war is one of those situations where there are situations every day where you can demonstrate your bravery and your altruism.
Yeah.
And war, for much of human history and in many human societies, has been a kind of rite of passage for young men to demonstrate their worth to their people.
You went to you weren't really that old. I mean, you went to Bosnia, and this was in the mid-90s. You covered the siege of Sarajevo. That was one of the things that you saw over there. And and I wonder what you learned about that, because this is where you sort of – in the part of the book where you kind of shift away from just soldiers' experience to civilians' experience. What did you learn about communities that were dealing with something as devastating as that and how they reacted?
Yeah. I mean, in my book, I look at different situations where modern society has collapsed. And, you know, how do people react? We are still wired for this sort of communal existence in a harsh environment. And it's not that hard to reproduce. Yeah. The Blitz in London did it pretty quickly.
Right.
30,000 Londoners were killed during the Blitz. Complete strangers were sleeping shoulder to shoulder in the subway platforms. Terrible, terrible time. And the authorities were braced for mass psychiatric casualties and people freaking out in the streets, right? They're getting bombed by the German Air Force every night. And the opposite happened. The admissions to psych wards went down during the bombing in London. As one official said, we have neurotics driving ambulances. I mean, everyone sort of felt that they were needed, and that allowed them to that sort of buffered many people from their psychological demons. The first war that I ever covered was Sarajevo in 1993-94 during the siege. Basically a modern army encircled a modern city and used the civilians for target practice for 3 years, and they killed or wounded one-fifth of the civilian population of that city. And I was there during those days, and I had my first chance to go back last summer, actually, and I met a woman named Nidzara, who actually interviewed me for a Bosnian newspaper, but then I turned the tables on her and said, okay, let me interview you. Right. She had lived through the siege. She was wounded in the early days of the war by a fragment from a Serb tank round that hit her parents' apartment. The doctors managed to – she took shrapnel in her leg, and the doctors managed to save her leg, but they had to perform extensive surgery without anesthesia. If you imagine what that felt to a 17-year-old girl. And she said to me last summer, she said, you know, the war was so terrible, but we all miss it. Now, this isn't some macho soldier who's into combat. This is a woman who survived the war as a 17-year – badly wounded 17-year-old. She said, we were better people then. We lived for each other. You know, we were selfless. We were generous. And she said, now, you know, things are better and we're all living our lives and but we don't feel as good. We all miss it. And she said that there's graffiti in Bosnia that says somewhere, I don't know where, that says things were better when they were bad, referring to the war. And that really says a lot when you have – so in missing war, when you have – as a young woman said to me once, I met a young woman while I was on book tour who said that she'd had cancer and that her people, her family, her community had rallied around her and she'd managed to survive. She'd beat the odds and she looked at me sadly and said, and now I miss being sick. When you have people missing war, people missing being ill, you know that there's something missing in normal everyday life.
You know, one of the questions then is, okay, so people who are experiencing, natural disasters or war, you know, they have a common purpose. They bind together. It gives them a sense of belonging. But how does that translate? How does that translate? I read one journalist who was talking about your book who said that the actual threats of modern society, like cyber terrorism or epidemics, those kinds of things, those are different, she says, in terms of time and space from people gathering in bomb shelters during the London Blitz. But I wondered, is it different? Are they different? How do you translate that same sense of belonging into a really comfortable society that we're in these days?
I'm not sure you can. I mean, not every problem has a solution.
Right.
I think what people do. I think what people do long for is a sense of egalitarianism in their society. I looked at an earthquake in Italy in 1915 in the area of Avezzano. 96% of the population was killed in 1 minute. And the few survivors sort of huddled around their campfires waiting for help to come, and it took days. And written accounts from this earthquake say that all class differences disappeared. Rich and poor didn't matter. People were just helping each other. That earthquake reproduced our evolutionary past instantaneously. And one of the survivors said in this very eloquent way, he said that the earthquake produced what the law promises but cannot in fact deliver, which is the equality of all men. So, you know, are we going to create a communal society because we're facing a cyber threat? No, of course we're not.
Right.
But one thing we can do is actually strive to create a society that has the very real human goods that occur in communalism, but maybe we can create that in a sprawling modern society. In other words, if egalitarianism is the result of communalism, maybe we can just cut straight to the egalitarianism, and that's where injustices like the real crime that was perpetrated on the American people in 2008, that's where injustices like that erode our sense of living in an egalitarian society. And as a result, erode our mental health.
It's interesting. You kind of make a you write about the current toxic political discourse and the something more than just debates, that it's sort of gotten to this point of contempt. And contempt is a word you kind of break down a little bit, and I wanted you to spend some time with that. Like, what does this current political context, what does that mean for all of this? Conservatives versus liberals, Where does that fit in how you're thinking about this?
Yeah, I mean, humans are messy. Democracy's messy. It's all a fascinating mess. And of course, in any group of humans, there's going to be disagreement, conflict, hatred, all kinds of things. But if you look at, for example, at soldiers in combat, I mean, you had lots of problems in a platoon, interpersonal problems. But the one thing I never ever saw out there, and those guys were under a lot of stress. The one thing I never saw out there was open contempt for anyone inside the wire. Like, you might not like the guy. You might disagree with him all day long. In fact, you might hate him.
Yeah.
But if you're going to depend on him for your survival, if you are prepared to risk your life to save his life, contempt is just not one of the things you're going to feel. And I point that out in my book because there are very, very powerful people in this country right now, politicians, media leaders, who speak with open contempt about our president, about segments of the population, about the government. They're speaking with contempt about people inside the wire. I mean, these are our people. This is our community, right? And we don't know that overnight we're not going to be turned into one huge combat outpost in this country. I mean, on September 10th, 2001, we had no idea what was coming, right? And we still don't know what's coming. And so my point is, like, not only might we all need each other at some point if things get bad enough and who knows, but even if that doesn't happen, using that tone, using that – I mean, disagree all you want. Argue. I don't care. It's great for democracy to have debate like that. But when you when you speak about people in this country as if they don't deserve to be part of this country, as if they're actually somehow an enemy of the state, people literally talk about our president like that. When you do that, what you're communicating is that you actually don't think we live in a national entity. You actually don't believe in shared goals and a common good. You're effectively saying we don't have a country. And I think the vast majority of Americans, when you think about it in those terms, would immediately reject that kind of contempt like they reject that sort of open racism that was, you know, quite common and acceptable, say, 50 years ago in public discourse.
Sebastian Junger is with us. His new book is Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. We need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Sebastian Junger. We're talking about his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. You write about this experience in Afghanistan. This was in 2010. This was a year before 9/11. And you say, you mention being unprepared for the aftermath of this experience. So I want to talk about the aftermath part, but let's start with the experience itself. I wanted to have you read this section. So you're with these troops with the Northern Alliance, and there's you experienced this attack. You describe as feeling deranged for days after the experience. Maybe set this up a little bit, and I want to have you read this section, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, in the fall of 2000, a year before 9/11, the Taliban had an air force. They had MiGs. They had tanks. They were fighting Ahmad Shah Massoud. I was with Massoud's forces, and those guys had barely anything.
Yeah.
And we came under rocket attack at a frontline position that the Northern Alliance had just stormed, had just taken over from the Taliban. I mean, the heavy machine guns were still pointed the wrong way. And they counterattacked with this hour-long rocket barrage that actually killed one of our horses. And we were sort of curled up in trenches. I was completely terrified. And there was nothing we could do. We had to wait for them to run out of rockets, and it took quite a while. I came home to the United States after 2 months. I was a young man. I didn't think anything affected me. I didn't know that combat could really create some scars until this moment in New York City. By the time I got home, I'd stopped thinking about the attack on that hill or any of the other horrific things we'd seen, casualties from an infantry assault through a minefield, starving civilians, MiG jets circling us looking for a place to drop their bombs. I mentally buried all of it until one day a few months later when I went into the subway at rush hour to catch the C train downtown. Suddenly I found myself backed up against an iron support column, convinced I was going to die. For some reason, everything seemed like a threat. There were too many people on the platform, the trains were moving too fast, the lights were too bright, the world was too loud. I couldn't really explain what was wrong, but I was more scared than I'd ever been in Afghanistan. I stood there with my back to the column until I couldn't take it anymore, and then I sprinted for the exit and walked home. The nation wasn't at war yet, and I had no idea that what I'd just experienced had anything to do with combat. I just thought I was going crazy. For the next several months, I kept having panic attacks whenever I was in a small place with too many people, airplanes, ski gondolas, bars. The incidents eventually stopped happening. I didn't think about it again until 2 or 3 years later, when I found myself at a family picnic talking to a woman who worked as a psychotherapist. The United States had just invaded Iraq, and that may have been what prompted her to ask whether I'd been traumatized by the wars I'd covered. I told her that I didn't think so, but that for a while I'd had panic attacks in crowded places. She nodded. "That's called post-traumatic stress disorder," she said. "You'll be hearing a lot more about that in the next few years."
And of course we did.
Yeah.
Which you write about in the last portion of the book. How important is this idea of recovery? Because this is one of the things you write about, a rapid recovery from psychological trauma. Rapid recovery may have been an important part of our evolutionary past, but American soldiers have a really slow recovery. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, PTSD, like depression, I mean, these are to some degree subjective experiences that are really hard to quantify, really hard to measure.
Yeah.
But we're primates, we're animals. We, like all mammals, have evolved to survive in very harsh circumstances. And when something dangerous and traumatic happens to us, our survival adaptations have us do certain things. We for a while, we will jump at sudden noises. That makes sense if your life has been threatened, that you want to be alert and reactive to unfamiliar sounds. We get a little bit depressed. That keeps us quiet, keeps us removed from the action, keeps us safe. We're quick to anger. That keeps us ready to fight. We have dreams and nightmares about the thing that could kill us. It keeps us sort of cognizant of the danger that we're in. All classic PTSD symptoms that are adaptive and help us survive in the short term, survive a threat to our life. What's not adaptive is getting stuck in those reactions for years, decades, a lifetime. That's long-term chronic PTSD. And what seems to be the case is that almost 100% of traumatized people have those classic short-term reactions, as well they should. But only around 20% of people wind up with long-term PTSD. In American soldiers, the percentage is much higher. And so the question is why? Like what is happening when these soldiers come home? Why do they feel so why do they feel like their lives are still in danger? Why do they feel alienated, depressed? Why do they feel they don't fit in? Why do many of them want to go back to war? What is going on?
It seems like the answer is the return, because this is one of the main points in the book, that recovery is influenced heavily by the society you return to. And they're returning to a society that has this kind of, this is how you describe it in the book, this low social resilience, all the indicators of that. And I guess that's your point, right? I mean, that they're returning to the society that doesn't have this kind of cohesiveness. So PTSD in some ways isn't necessarily just about the experience of war. It's returning to a society that doesn't have the same elements that they found appealing, the sharing and the bonding.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, war is not the only place you can be traumatized.
Of course.
I mean, civilians are – I mean, just – you know, sometimes people sort of slip into that idea, but you know, life's traumatic. I mean, there's car accidents, there's spouses dying of cancer. I mean, there's all kinds of horrible stuff that happens to people all the time. So we're all in a position to be traumatized. Soldiers, maybe most predictably, but still only 10% of the U.S. military is even engaged in any combat.
Yeah.
But a much greater percentage than that experience psychological difficulties when they come home, much like Peace Corps volunteers. If you volunteer for the Peace Corps, you spend a couple of years in a remote village in Cameroon or whatever it may be. You're experiencing, like in a platoon, you're experiencing a very close, cohesive, communal human environment that reproduces our evolutionary past pretty closely. And then you come back to modern society, and around 25% of Peace Corps volunteers go into a real depression when they come home, sort of analogous to soldiers, actually. And these people weren't traumatized, right?
Yeah.
So what that reveals, I think, is that those psychological issues, they're akin to, you know, another set of statistics that I found, which was that as wealth goes up in a society, the suicide rate tends to go up, not down.
Yeah.
The depression rate tends to go up, not down, with wealth. If you asked my friend in Bosnia, Nizara, about why would that be? What she would say is that as you get wealthier, you can lead these selfish individual lives. You don't need your community, and that's a great liberation from the group. But it's also there's a real loss there, and it presents a real psychological hardship.
We were talking earlier about, you know, this question of we've become detribalized. So how do you? This seems like the big question. How do you impose some of these tribal ideals on modern society? I mean, you mentioned after both world wars, for example, that Indian veterans were able to return to these traditional ceremonies. But you're pretty honest about this. You say contemporary American society, we can't just borrow from Indian culture. Like, it's not going to work that way. So are you saying we need to find our own kinds of ceremonies, our own kind of community ceremonies?
Yeah, I mean, let me just start by saying that if we were taking calls right now, your phones would be ringing off the hook because people would be calling in, understandably so, saying, but wait a minute, tribalism can also be very malevolent.
Sure,
and some people would point to Trump's followers as acting sort of tribally in very destructive ways. That's a completely legitimate point. What I would say in response is it's just how big do you want to define your tribe? If we define our tribe as Americans, as our entire nation, you know, then we're good. And I would I mean, tribalism is good or bad depending on how you use it. And I would argue that some politicians actually use it in a destructive way. But that said, how do we create a sort of positive tribal identity that encompasses our entire nation? I think there's a couple of ways. I think mandatory national service, which is not the draft. I mean, the draft is a wartime measure that puts guns in people's hands. I think it's immoral to make someone fight a war that they don't believe in. But mandatory national service with a military option, I think, would be an incredible thing. It would take all, you know, rich, poor, black, white, put everyone in a pot and stir them up. And it would give young people the chance that I was actually dying for when I was 18, the chance to participate in something greater than yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, things have value when you make sacrifices for them. And I think one of the tragedies of a wealthy modern society is that it never asks for any sacrifice from anybody. So I think that would be very helpful very beneficial to the country. And also, I had this idea for what I call the Veteran Town Hall.
Yeah.
If you go to my website, sebastianyounger.com, there's a page devoted to Veteran Town Halls. And basically the idea is that on Veterans Day, you open up the door of your town hall, the civic center of your community, and veterans of any war have the right to stand up for 10 minutes and say anything they want about what the war felt like to them. And they say it to a room full of people from that community. And if you say that you support the troops or whatever, you know, any of those sort of empty slogans, that would mean showing up at the town hall and hearing these people out. Some are going to be very proud of their service and frankly are going to miss the war in some ways. Some are going to be very angry and some are going to be really actively grieving and crying. But all of that is the experience of war. And when veterans can actually share that with their community, it makes the war everyone's experience, everyone's problem, and it takes the burden off the vets. And I think actually in the long run creates a real cohesion in the community, in our entire society that we desperately need.
Mm. You worry about the creating victims out of veterans. You don't want that. What you're saying in the book you mention is you want vets need to come to this place, and I suppose all of us, where we feel necessary. That's where we feel like we have this kind of purpose. You talk about jobs and the way we think about jobs. Would you finally say something about that?
Yeah, I found a wonderful painting by Winslow Homer. And it was painted, and this is important, it was painted in the fall of 1865 during the harvest season, immediately after the end of the Civil War. And it shows a young man in a field with a scythe harvesting wheat. And it's called A Veteran in New Fields. So think about that. Like, that guy months earlier had a gun in his hand and was fighting. And we all know how horrific the American Civil War was, right? And months later, he was on a farm harvesting wheat. And basically his family, his community, his society said, look, we still need you. I mean, well done on the war. But, you know it's not over. I mean, now there's another war, which is we have to get the wheat in.
Yeah.
And I think the response that we've had to vets is a compensation for a very heartfelt compensation for the awful way that vets were treated after Vietnam. But everything has an upside and a downside. The downside, the risk of it, is that when you classify PTSD as a lifelong disability, you're basically saying to the veteran, look, we don't need you. Society doesn't need you anymore. We'll pay you $3,000 a month. You can watch TV for the rest of your life. We really don't need you. And it actually – that doesn't promote psychological healing. It actually promotes psychological stagnation. And to the extent that any of these people can contribute to society, I think they should be urged to. And I think there are enormous benefits to it. But of course, it's a very delicate political matter to say that.
Sebastian Younger, his book is Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging, joined us from New York. Sebastian, thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.